the land.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a fascinating thing if we had recordings of what the dial sounded like and how many stations were playing Alice's Restaurant. Every year, I write up a guide that is, an incomplete list, but a list of stations that are planning to play this 18.
You know, I was wondering, if you could keep on, because the force, it's got a lot of power, and it makes me feel like, it makes me feel like.
You're listening to WGXC 90.7.
You're listening to WGXC
Catskill
90.7.
You're listening to WGXC
Catskill
90.7.
You're listening to WGXC
Catskill 90.7.
You're listening to WG.
Listening to Zach Poff's Pond Station, available at wavefarm.org/listen. If you click on the listen button on any WGXC.org page, you can hear the sounds from the bottom of one of the wave farm ponds, thanks to the hydrophones Zach Poff has put there. The radio artist is surveilling the underwater sounds in Greene County, and you can go to wavefarm.org/listen or click on any WGXC.org page and click on the listen button to listen to transmissions from inside a wave farm pond from morning until sundown from Zach Poff's Pond Station.
The Cellar and Point call themselves a garage chamber septet, and we'll hear their jazz infused with flourishes of electronics and rock on the next Deep Threes. Plus music from Johnny Greenwood, Louise Rossiter, Core, and Kirill Platonkin. Deep Threes, where will the music take you?
Tune in to Deep Threes after the noon news on Monday at WGXC 90.7 FM.
Wave Farm programs are made possible in part by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program, administered in Greene County by CREATE, the Alexander and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors, including WGXC's sustaining supporters, who provide critical monthly support to Wave Farm's radio station, WGXC 90.7 FM. Thank you.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Adam Weinert of Hudson, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
I was just going to lie down for 5 minutes, take a little nap.
Yeah, a regular Rip Van Winkle.
Who?
Another guy that took a little nap, woke up, and didn't know where he was.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Joshua Solomon reports in the Times Union that after two recent mass shootings targeting black grocery shoppers in Buffalo and elementary school children in Texas, Governor Kathy Hochul is not proposing to ban sales of AR-15 semi-automatic weapons in New York, but she does want to limit sales to those 21 years and above. Hochul said from the New York State Intelligence Center in Rensselaer County, where she attended a meeting of the interstate flow of illegal guns, and I quote, "How does an 18-year-old purchase an AR-15 in the state of New York? That person is not old enough to buy a legal drink. I want to work with the legislature to change that," end quote. The federal assault weapons ban restricted the sale of the AR-15 in the United States from 1994 to 2004. But since they are legal in this country, and the number of deaths from mass shooting has skyrocketed in the United States, both of the shooters in Buffalo and Texas were 18 years old. Mike Murphy, a spokesperson for the state Senate Majority Leader's office, said about raising the legal age for purchasing the military-style weapons, and I quote, "This is something we have been discussing, and we have always been supportive of this idea and would certainly be in favor of moving forward," end quote. But the language of such a bill will need to be carefully written, as in March, a federal court deemed California's ban on people under 21 buying semi-automatic weapons unconstitutional. Hochul suggested that New York lawmakers may also take other steps to address the numerous mass shootings. Hochul said, and I quote, "We will do more, and I will not sleep at night until I know that everything has been done humanly possible to protect New Yorkers and to help them heal," end quote. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Nick Reisman reports for New York State of Politics that state police troopers are being sent to New York schools from now until the end of the year to conduct daily check-ins after an 18-year-old murdered 19 children and two adults at a Texas elementary school on May 24th. The next day, Governor Kathy Hochul announced the police visits to schools. Hochul said, and I quote, "I want parents who have enough to worry about in their daily lives, the cost of gas at the pump, the cost of groceries, maybe putting aside money. They have enough to worry about. Let them know the state police and local law enforcement are there to protect them," end quote. But parents may worry if they read the news about the Texas shooting because a school resource officer was at the school but failed to stop the murderous rampage. Andy Pallotta, the president of the New York State United Teachers Labor Organization, said, and I quote, What will it take to put a stop to these hateful, sickening acts of violence? Our schools must be a safe place for all. As we mourn those who have lost their lives, we must also stand up and demand better for our children, for parents, for educators, and for communities across the nation. End quote. Read more about this story at New York State of Politics. On Twitter, May 24th, after an 18-year-old murdered 19 children and two adults at an elementary school, local politicians offered fewer, and I quote, thoughts and prayers, end quote, than at most mass shootings, and instead offered vague calls for, and I quote, action, end quote. Both of the candidates for the special election for the 19th congressional district seat used that word. Democrat Pat Ryan tweeted, and I quote, 10 days ago we saw a horrific racist act of gun violence at a grocery store in Buffalo, and today we have yet another mass shooting at an elementary school in Texas. We need real action to end gun violence, and we need real leaders with a backbone to say enough is enough, end quote. His Republican opponent, Mark Molinaro, tweeted a similar message. He wrote, and I quote, it is heartbreakingly clear we need action where our words have failed and consensus where contention has divided us. I believe we all have a role to play in finding solutions and rise to the challenge, end quote. Neither offered anything specific. Other politicians were even more vague. Representative Antonio Delgado, who resigned May 25th from the 19th Congressional District, tweeted, and I quote, my heart is breaking for the parents, loved ones, fellow students, teachers, and every single person affected by the horrific and tragic shooting in Uvalde. Our kids should feel safe and secure when they go to school, to the grocery store, to the movies. We need change now, end quote. Republican Assembly Member Chris Teague, who represents Greene County and the 102nd District, did not call for any action at all. Teague tweeted, tonight, the hearts of all New Yorkers and all Americans are with the victims, families, and first responders of the horrible tragedy that occurred today in Uvalde, Texas. Thomas Frank reports for CNBC that New York-based Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer failed to pass legislation introduced after the mass shooting of blacks at a grocery store in Buffalo, 2 days after a mass shooting of elementary school children in Texas. Frank wrote, Schumer, and I quote, pleaded with his Republican colleagues on Wednesday to consider the bill, end quote, but to no avail. The vote on the Domestic Terrorism Prevention Act was 47-47. With the Senate's odd rules favoring the minority by requiring 60 votes to pass the legislation. On May 18th, the U.S. House of Representatives voted for the bill 222-203, with Democrats Paul Tonko, Sean Maloney, and Antonio Delgado on the record in favor, and Republican Elise Stefanik voting against. Delgado did not actually vote for the bill, as he turned over his vote on May 10th to Colorado Representative Joe Neguse, claiming he was, and I quote, unable to physically attend proceedings in the House chamber due to the ongoing public emergency, end quote. Delgado resigned May 25th to become New York's lieutenant governor without announcing any COVID infection. While Schumer was ineffective in passing legislation to slow the spate of mass shootings on May 25th, he did block a Republican bill, he said, and I quote, could see more guns in school, end quote. The Luke and Alex School Safety Act that Schumer blocked was about collecting data to increase the presence of law enforcement on school campuses. Schumer tweeted, and I quote, the truth, there were officers at the school in Texas. The shooter got past them. We need real solutions. We will vote on gun legislation, starting with the Domestic Terrorism Prevention Act, end quote. And that vote failed. Read more about this story at the CNBC website.
Nick Reisman reports for New York State of Politics that on May 25th, a federal court turned back a legal challenge to a New York State law that makes it easier to bring lawsuits against gun manufacturers. New York Attorney General Letitia James said, and I quote, "As we mourn the deaths of 19 innocent children lost to gun violence in Uvalde and the countless more in Buffalo and across America every day, this is a moment of light and hope. New York is proud to defend the right to reasonable gun restrictions that protect all of us. As public officials, we were elected to solve problems and address the needs of the people. Prayers alone will no longer do, and cowardliness is not part of the job description. New York will always lead, and I urge others with a backbone to follow," end quote. The celebration will most likely be short, as the radical Supreme Court is expected to soon strike down New York's strict concealed gun carry provision. Governor Kathy Hochul said on May 25th that she would call a special legislative session this summer to address the ruling if the law is overturned. In the final weeks of New York's current legislative session, Democrats are expected to tighten the state's red flag law meant to keep guns away from people deemed to be a danger. Read more about this story at New York State of Politics. Emily Munson in the Times Union tracks the 76 school shooting incidents since 1971 in New York. That number comes from the Advanced Thinking in Homeland Security program at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School Center for Homeland Security and Defense, which counts a school shooting incident, and I quote, "when a gun is brandished, is fired, or a bullet hits school property for any reason, regardless of the number of victims, time of day, or day of week," end quote. By definition, there have been four shootings at New York schools this year, in Staten Island, Brooklyn, Buffalo, and Mount Vernon. Of the known cases since 1971, 33 of the perpetrators were between 13 and 17 years old, and four were 18 years old, and eight were 21 years of age or older. Handguns were used in most of these incidents, with rifles used in four cases. Munson writes, and I quote, "The 76 incidents produced 97 victims, most of them male students who were wounded. In nearly all the incidents, one or two people were injured or killed," end quote. FBI records say there were 10 active shooting incidents in New York from the year 2000 through the year 2019. Read more about this story in the Times Union.
David Cruz reports at the Gothamist about the reactions to the murder of 19 elementary school children and two adults in Texas from Republicans running for governor in New York. Long Island Representative Lee Zeldin tweeted condolences. Andrew Giuliani, the son of former Mayor Rudy Giuliani, urged his Twitter followers to, and I quote, "pray together with me for them," end quote. Millionaire hedge fund manager Harry Wilson called the shooting, and I quote, "unimaginable and unacceptable," on Twitter. Former Westchester County Executive Rob Astorino called for, and I quote, "enhanced background checks," end quote, but criticized politicians who, and I quote, "rushed out to shamefully politicize this tragedy," end quote. Read the full story. Read more about this story at the Gothamist. Annie McDonald reports for NYN Media about how the now radical U.S. Supreme Court will probably soon overturn New York's rules about who can carry a concealed firearm in public. Scott Lemieux, a teaching professor of political science at the University of Washington, said of Tuesday's shooting in Texas, and I quote, "we are now in an age in which the court is heavily polarized along party lines. 30 years ago, this kind of event could have made a difference. The reality is that there is pretty strong opposition among Republican elites to gun control. If Sandy Hook didn't change that, if the Orlando shooting didn't change that, it just seems unlikely that this is going to do it," end quote. The New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin decision is expected by the end of June. Two Rensselaer County residents brought the suit after applying for unrestricted licenses to carry handguns for self-defense. Instead, they got restricted licenses to carry handguns in specific settings, including hunting and target shooting. They claimed that was unconstitutional under the Second and Fourteenth Amendments. Eric Rubin, an assistant professor at Southern Methodist University's Dedman School of Law and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, said, and I quote, "It seems like there's a majority of the Supreme Court who is skeptical about the constitutionality of New York's restriction." Chief Justice John Roberts said in November, and I quote, "You don't have to say when you're looking for a permit to speak on a street corner or whatever that, you know, your speech is particularly important. So why do you have to show in this case, convince somebody that you're entitled to exercise your Second Amendment right?" End quote. The state legislature is also expected to respond to the ruling. State Senator Michael Giannaris said, and I quote, "We're not going to just sit back at a time of increasing gun violence and not react when the Supreme Court puts us in greater danger than we're already in. So you can rest assured that the legislature will move very quickly," end quote. Read more about this story at NYN Media. Ryan Whalen reports for New York State of Politics that Governor Kathy Hochul is moving forward with a proposal to block anyone under 21 years old from buying AR-15-style weapons, even though a California court recently struck down a similar law. In the last 2 weeks, 18-year-olds have used semi-automatic AR-15-style guns to commit mass murders in Buffalo and Uvalde, Texas. A few weeks ago, a California court ruled against banning 18-year-olds there from purchasing similar weapons. Hochul said, and I quote, "I'm not going to let my fear of losing a court case to stop me from what I think is correct for New Yorkers and will protect them because you may get a good judge also who actually cares and has common sense and would understand that these are not punitive measures. We have the right to protect people as well, and I'll make that argument in court any day of the week," end quote. Former New York State Supreme Court Justice Penny Wolfgang agreed. She said, and I quote, "There was a dissent in the decision, number one, and number two, California is a different state from New York. Different court, different judges, and there may very well be a different interpretation," end quote. But when inevitable appeals of any potential lawsuit over the New York law head to the U.S. Supreme Court, will it have a chance to survive? Read more about this story at New York State of Politics. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, or COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice holiday weekend.
New York State lawmakers are weighing two bills which would grant utilities more vertical market power. It's a move proponents argue will help the state meet its clean energy goals, but one advocacy group says it would grant utilities too much control. Essentially, the measures would let private utility companies and the New York Power Authority construct and own clean energy projects. Ann Reynolds is with the Alliance for Clean Energy New York. She contends it's unwise to let utilities, which already own the wires that deliver the electricity, develop wind and solar projects. Reynolds says that would put independent power projects like the ones they represent at a real disadvantage.
They will then sell the power to themselves and decide for themselves what price they're going to pay for it. So we have a lot of pressure to keep the price as low as possible, and the utilities wouldn't have that pressure.
Costs for the utilities are automatically passed on to ratepayers, but independent projects can't do that. The bill's authors argue the proposals would streamline clean energy production, although Reynolds contends most of the holdup there is in the permitting and planning process, not construction. New York aims to reach net zero emissions by 2040, with a mid-range goal of 70% renewable energy by 2030. The state's Public Service Commission has previously advised against permitting utility-owned clean energy projects, agreeing with Reynolds' argument. She adds the biggest barrier to new clean energy production is often connecting to the power grid, which is largely up to utility companies and grid operators.
Our worry is that they will give themselves a break when deciding which interconnection request to process first or how much to charge for an interconnection request.
The Public Service Commission has reopened public comment on the issue until August 10th, but those comments will be moot if the bills pass before then. Neither bill has been voted on by either house. The legislative session is set to end on June 2nd. For the New York News Connection, I'm Jonah Chester. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
And now here is your WGXE weather update. Your forecast for the holiday weekend, well, on Saturday, there will be a chance of showers and thunderstorms between 10 a.m. and 5 p.m. It will be partly sunny with a temperature high near 74 degrees. On Saturday night, a chance of more showers mainly after 7 p.m., but it will be mostly clear with a temperature low of around 54 degrees. On Sunday, it will be sunny with a temperature high near 80 degrees, and Sunday night mostly clear with a temperature low of around 58 degrees. And on Monday, Memorial Day, it will be mostly sunny with a temperature high near 88 degrees, and Monday night mostly cloudy with a temperature low of around 66. And that is your weather update from WGXC, 90.7 FM, radio for open ears in Greene and Columbia counties.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Nora E. Edelman of Athens, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to WGXC.org and click Donate. Thank you for your support.
WGXC believes in creative use of the airwaves. WGXC is a program division of the nonprofit arts organization Wave Farm, based in Acre, New York. We are the only station in the country to dedicate significant airtime to radio as an artistic medium. Tune in to transmission art and experimental sound programming overnight and on Saturdays, and hear artists from all over the world who sculpt and compose with the airwaves.
Overture, candlelights, this is it, the night of nights. No more rehearsing and nursing apart. We know every card by heart. Overture, candlelights, this is it. We'll hit the heights, and oh, what heights we'll hit. On with the show, this is it.
This is Tom Rowe with Wave Farm with the WGXC Radio News daily update on what's going on in broadcast news. In the analog era of broadcasting, television stations transmitting on Channel 6 could also be heard on 87.7 FM. WRGB-TV in Albany, for instance, used to be heard on both Channel 6 television and 87.7 FM on radio receivers that could be tuned below 88. But since the full-power television stations switched to digital broadcast, now all that is heard on FM there is static. July 2021, all of the remaining analog low-power television stations, except 13, were required to convert to digital. That means there is just static on the dial, or pirate radio stations, on 87.7 FM around the country, except for 13 stations. That could change. The broadcast Lol blog reports that the Federal Communications Commission has issued a draft notice of proposed rulemaking for its June 8th open meeting on a proposal to authorize low-power television stations operating on Channel 6 to continue to provide an analog audio stream on FM radios at 87.7. The broadcast industry calls these stations Franken FM, since they are both television and radio stations. More importantly, the FCC proposal also asks for comments about whether, with the elimination of most Channel 6 television stations broadcasting audio on 87.7, the frequencies 82 through 88 megahertz could be used for more radio stations in geographic areas where it is not currently used for TV services. So, in Albany, where you could once hear the audio from the Channel 6 TV station, a new FM radio station could possibly be broadcasting in a few years. Matthew Rosa reports for Salon that the radio signals that humans have sent the farthest distance may be having problems getting any further. On September 5, 1977, NASA launched the Voyager 1 space probe, which has now traveled 14.5 billion miles away from Earth. Radio signals to and from the Voyager 1 now take 20 hours and 33 minutes to reach each other. Voyager 1 is so far away it has left our universe and is now in the interstellar void of the Milky Way. But it is losing power, and the interstellar void seems to be creating havoc. Quote, the Interstellar Explorer is operating normally, receiving and executing commands from Earth, along with gathering and returning science data, unquote, NASA said on its website. Quote, but readouts from the probe's attitude, articulation, and control systems don't reflect what's actually happening on board, unquote. Suzanne Dodd, project manager for Voyager 1 and 2 at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Southern California, explains further. Quote, we're also in interstellar space, a high radiation environment that no spacecraft have flown in before. So there are some big challenges for the engineering team. But I think there's a way to solve this issue with the AACS. Our team will find it, unquote. The Voyager 1 probe is so far into space that astronomers can now hear the hum that our solar system produces as the spacecraft travels outside of it. The hum is interstellar gas, also known as plasma waves. Quote, it's very faint and monotone because it is in a narrow frequency bandwidth, unquote, said Stella Koch-Ulker, a doctoral student in the Department of Astronomy and Cornell Center for Astrophysics and Planetary Science. Quote, we're detecting the faint, persistent hum of interstellar gas, unquote. Scientists may keep hearing that hum through 2025, when the radioisotope thermoelectric generators will no longer have enough energy to keep transmitting. Joe Constance claims at Bloomberg that New York City removed its last freestanding public payphone from city sidewalks on May 23rd, moving it into the Museum of the City of New York exhibit Analog City. The phone booths at many locations are being replaced with digital Wi-Fi kiosks. Quote, truly the end of an era, but also hopefully the start of a new one with more equity in technology access, unquote, Manhattan Borough President Mark Levine tweeted. The digital kiosks include free phone call capabilities, interactive maps, and USB charging stations. While New York City may be removing all of its payphones, they are still on sidewalks elsewhere. Right on the sidewalk on North 4th Street in Hudson, across from the WGX studio, there is a payphone. Inside Radio reports that National Public Radio host Terry Gross won this year's Peabody Institutional Award. Gross started in radio in 1973 at public radio station WBFO in Buffalo. In 1975, she moved to WHYY in Philadelphia as producer and host of Fresh Air, which was then a local daily interview and music program. In 1985, WHYY expanded a weekly half-hour edition of the show nationally by NPR. Fresh Air became a daily one-hour show in 1987. The show became the first non-drive-time show in public radio history to reach more than 5 million listeners weekly in the fall of 2008. Here's Stephen Colbert introducing Gross for the award.
There's nothing out there quite like Fresh Air with Terry Gross. It began as a local program in 1975 on WHYY in Philadelphia, but now it celebrates 35 years as a daily national broadcast. This NPR staple is where many of us come for some of the most insightful interviews anywhere. Over the decades, it's become a place where artists, musicians, actors, directors, playwrights, authors, poets, showrunners, talk show hosts open up about their work, their process, and their life. The show is co-executive produced by Danny Miller and directed by Roberta Shurrock, but it is host and co-executive producer Terry Gross who's front and center. Her sultry voice and impish laugh are unmistakable, iconic even. Over the years, Terry has perfected a singular kind of interview. She's part conversationalist, part therapist, and part oral historian. She effortlessly brings out the unexpected in her guests. Above all, she's a great listener, attentive and probing without ever feeling intrusive.
ProPublica takes a deep dive into the rollout of 5G wireless technology and how that affected airplanes. The Federal Aviation Administration objected to the Federal Communication Commission's authorization of 5G networks near airports, but the story paints both agencies as incompetent industry toadies. There's no problem with the 5G technology, but with the altimeters of planes. They are often older and not designed for our new digital world with more radio signals whizzing all around. The FAA was concerned that altimeters on planes used in automated aircraft landings would accidentally receive 5G radio signals and not give pilots proper readings. Aviation experts warned of, quote, catastrophic failures leading to multiple fatalities, unquote, the story says. In January, an agreement was struck with Verizon and AT&T temporarily not turning on more than 600 5G transmission towers near the runways of 87 airports and reducing the power of others. ProPublica traced the entire story, revealing, quote, profound failures, unquote, at the FCC. On July 5th, the temporary agreement expires, but aviation officials say that it would take 2 years to replace the older altimeters. Quote, the rhetoric of the FCC chief is almost identical to that of the industry she regulates. As recently as last month, Jessica Rosenworkel, the Biden-appointed FCC chair, dismissed aviation concerns as, in effect, a shakedown, a ploy to get telecom companies to fund a nationwide upgrade of airplane equipment, unquote, the story says. Even if another agreement is struck in July, quote, T-Mobile and other wireless companies are approved to roll out additional 5G service at the end of 2023, using a C-band frequency even closer to the one used by the airplane safety equipment, unquote, ProPublica reports. Quote, the wireless companies have made it very clear they're not going to agree to an open-ended situation, unquote, one FAA official told ProPublica. Quote, they seem willing to go past July 5th, as long as they know how far past, but they're making it clear their patience is not infinite, unquote. Read the entire ProPublica story on the Wavefarm newsroom at wavefarm.org.
Hi, folks. Before we begin taping today, I'd like to introduce you to Mr. Peter Jenks of the Federal Communications Commission. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Barris. I don't know if any of you are aware of this, but it's a federal offense to make lascivious remarks on a television network broadcast. The penalty for this disgusting, behavior is 1 year in prison or $10,000 fine or both. Anyone making a sick, subversive remark tonight will be arrested immediately. I then will personally escort the offender to federal prison for booking under edict number 364. Of the Broadcasting Act of 1963. And it's a long drive to that prison, baby. Just you and me. No witnesses.
Okay, have fun, buddy. All right.
Next, we tune in the latest episode of the I Have Seen Niagara radio theater show from G. Lucas Crane and Rick Royer. The show airs Saturday mornings on the WGXC Morning Show between 9 and 10 a.m. and every early Wednesday night just after midnight.
Hello, everybody. Hello, everybody on the other side.
Operation Midnight Fog. This is Bug Child. Code name Bug Child. Message to the Sunflower Team. I've been to the other side. I have returned. Not because I wanted to, but because it is imperative that I reach you to tell you all how wonderful it is here. If anyone is feeling reluctant to cross over, do not be afraid. It's everything that the brochure tells us and more. The water shapes a house at the end of the bed. It's magic. Shrank my gout. Now I can hold money again. You should see my whistle and how clean I keep. I dip in the space bubble here where there are no urns or tombstones because everyone is alive. Alive in a psychedelic world the color of dominoes. The odor of a good spouse. See skies of dragons. Hear four mounds of dirt. What more color in the book of nerves plowed by angels? And we even got a vitamin shop run by guys named Lanny. I do not feel guilty about sacrificing the innocent to access this dimension. We're all here together, prancing and laughing and whacking off together. Nobody misses loved ones. Our family is now the plants, animals, and food. Mother in the spinach. Daddy the lamb. First man to ride the lightning. No, wait. I see a shadow. I've been found. Please, no. Not the pig dog man. It was once a pig dog baby that grew to a shadow. Here to drag it back. I told him what you told me to. I told him it was good. I told him about the spinach. The whannies. No. There's your eyes. He comes and does. The tablet. The bonus rings. See me looking from the door to reflect you. Did you see that? I told him that somebody was there.
And that's where the tape ends. Gives me the chills every time I listen to it. Look. I don't ask a lot of questions here at my job, at the Ransomville Outdoor Flea Market and Auction House. I'm given a box of envelopes, I fold the envelopes, I put the envelopes in a folder, and I put the folders in a box. I do my job, and I go home. But when a box was accidentally delivered to my barn office that was full of flyers for missing men, women, and children, with this cassette tape taped to the bottom of the box, I knew something was fishy. Sure, I've seen a number of warning signs since I've been here. The crates of tie-dyed shirts, the drawers of fake beards, the trundle beds, full of unlicensed temporary Grateful Dead bear tattoos. But now it's all falling into place. See, the people I work for are Isidorians, the largest psychic spiritualist sect of water farmers this side of the Mississippi. They believe in the Christhood of Saint Isidore, the patron saint of farmers, and they make their living from selling handcrafted hummingbird feeders and experimental mind-altering drugs. They are the ones who are behind the sunflower cult. And they're just dressing up as deadheads when they pull off nefarious operations to throw everyone off, to get everyone to hate the hippies, and to rise up against them and take them out of power. Water farmers have been jockeying for dominion over the Eastern Ley Line Power Corridor for centuries, and their next move, I'm afraid, could have global ramifications. And because of what I may have uncovered, I feel like my life is in danger. I hope this recording falls into the right hands before the Imidorians realize that there is a mole in the flea. Wait. Did I say Imidorians? I meant Isidorians. My mind. It feels so open. Not just my mind, but the thing my mind is in. The skull. Split forehead so open wide you could fit a hoagie through it. A whole body through it even. Whoa. Dizzy. What? Between the slats of the barn walls, a mist. It seeps in. I hear them. Them. They are coming. The Isidorians. The Imidorians. The Imidors. Imidor. No. Imidor. No. Imidor. Imidor. No.
And the rest of the tape is just someone singing show tunes that was taped over.
You think this has anything to do with all them peoples that's gone missing?
Not a chance. Don't make anything of it. Just sounds like one of them punk rockster's pranks, and I'm not going to be on the tits end of no goddamn caper. And anyway, we've got bigger things to worry about. A semi-truck carrying a bunch of bins full of pumpkins just jackknifed on the 190. It's Halloween all over the highway. The only thing we could find of the driver so far was his two-bys. They were wide open with a look of fear. Just to be on the safe side, I want you to take that cassette tape down to the firing hole and put a few rounds in it. Can't let it come back to bite us right in the asshole. And by the way, on your way out, tell him to hold my calls. I'll be in here with the lights off, trying to do my ABCs in the dark.
Okay, bye.
A. B. C.
You gotta try something.
I got a job at the radio station.
Oh, great, that place. It's dark and dirty and has, like, what, those three weirdos who work there?
Monday, May 30th is Memorial Day, and Porcupine Soup rounds up where there are events for the holiday in Greene County. On Memorial Day itself, there are events in Athens, Greenville, Cairo, New Baltimore, Coxsackie, and Plattsville. In Athens, a parade starts at 9 a.m. on May 30th at Wheat Street, Route 385, with stops at the Triangle to lay wreath, and then proceeds up Franklin Street to TGM American Legion Post 187 with speakers and refreshments. Greenville's parade begins at 10:15 a.m. at St. John's Church, then heads down State Route 81 into the hamlet with a memorial service following the parade at Greenville Veterans Park Gazebo. Cairo's parade steps off at 11 a.m. near Schindler's Auto Shop on Main Street and heads to Angelo Cana Town Park with a memorial service with American Legion Mohican Post 983. There is also a Memorial Day ceremony at 11 a.m. at the Coyman's Hollow Fire Department, 1290 Route 143. Coxsackie's parade begins at 1 p.m. on Apple Blossom Lane and proceeds down Mansion Street with stops at the World War II Monument, the Mansion Street Cemetery, and the World War I Monument at the Church Corners before ending at Village Hall. And Prattsville's Virgil E. Deo American Legion Post 1327 hosts an annual Memorial Day parade at 1 p.m. with a Memorial Day ceremony to follow at the town green.
We're joined today by Dan Wilcox, local poet and peace activist, active with Veterans for Peace. We're going to be talking about the, I guess, this weekend's upcoming Memorial Day parade and the peace contingent. So, Dan, you know, Memorial Day, what does that have to do with peace and veterans?
Well, ultimately, I think it has a lot to do with that, because I think the earliest Memorial Day celebrations, in fact, the ones after World War One, were designed to promote peace and the end of war. Of course, we know that wasn't very successful. But currently in around the country, there are many, particularly on Memorial Day on Monday or throughout the weekend, there are parades, and they're characterized as a way to remember our fallen military, and they call them victims of the war. For a number of years, in fact, I think we first marched in 1999, Veterans for Peace has been able to participate in both the Memorial Day Parade and the Veterans Day Parade here in Albany with other more traditional veterans organizations. And we find it as an opportunity to bring this message of peace to the general population. And our point is that we're remembering not just the military victims, so to speak, but the civilian victims, true victims. So that's why we march both Veterans Day and Memorial Day. And I'm proud to say that it's gotten to the point where this has been routine, that routinely just before the parade, a month or so before, I get a call from the parade adjutant, and then I get the actual official printed parade orders a couple weeks later.
Are you always at the rear, or they moved you up over the years?
Oh, well, actually, we're usually towards the rear, but actually this year, as I look at it. Actually, I'm named as a division marshal on there. I don't know what I'm supposed to do, but we are the 6th division out of 11. So we're pretty close to the middle.
Now, this, of course, this year is a very troubling time. We have the Russian invasion of Ukraine going on, and, you know, United States sending over enormous amounts of weapons. We just finally got out of Afghanistan, and unfortunately, you know, mass killings have been quite in the news in recent few weeks. Are there any particular messages or themes you're trying to highlight this year?
Well, we're just trying the same message we do each year, that basically we want to end all wars, and we want to do that through ending militarization of our society. We're not against the military. They certainly play a role in defense or whatever. Some countries have gotten rid of their military. I don't really think that large major superpowers will ever get rid of their military. And we certainly don't have any animus towards people who are serving in the military. I served in the military. Members of Veterans for Peace have served in the military. Some of us reluctantly and some of us enthusiastically, and then changed their minds over the years. So our message it's the same each year. We just have a different focus.
You know, how do veterans, you know, react to the concept of war? Because, you know, obviously for many individuals is a very traumatic experience. A number of suicides among veterans and mental health issues are enormous in this country. You know, do many of them come away with the realization this is not something we should be engaged in? It's one thing to be defending your country, but, you know, these escapades we do with, like in the Middle East, just is not making sense any longer.
You know, veterans compose a fairly significant percentage of our population. So I really don't know how it plays out among all the different veterans organizations. And like everything else, there's probably two extremes to it. But I'll tell you an interesting anecdote that a few years back, it was, I think it was after the invasion of Afghanistan. I think it was even after, may have been right after the U.S. invaded Baghdad in Iraq. One of the organizers of the parade from the veterans organizations was actually a Green Beret in Vietnam. And he came up to me. He's got his clipboard and making sure we're all in our right place and everything. And he said to me, "I don't like this whole Iraq thing." He says, "We should be out of there." And then he says to me, "Can you get me a little tiny peace sign that I can wear on my lapel?" So yes, often over time, as a veteran see continuous wars, one after the other, they often change their mind, and often we get older veterans joining the Veterans for Peace.
Poet, I imagine you might have a poem for this occasion.
I have a couple of poems about marching in the Veterans Day Parade. It's called Morning Line, and it's based on a photograph I saw in the Times Union the day after the parade. Morning Line. In today's Times Union, gray print on a sunny morning, the picture of bejeweled Botox Mary Lou Whitney riding a dog sled to a tuxedo gala in summer Saratoga is printed beneath the picture of the Grafton Peace Walk, thin, bald, orange robe, June sun, chanting Namu Myo Ho Renge Kyo. Beats a flat drum, followed by young and old, walking in sneakers, sandals, baseball caps, t-shirts, waving flags, even one lone dog on their way to the Peace Pagoda. In this race to the end, dog sled versus sneakers, who are you betting on?
I'm curious also, does Veterans for Peace, you know, have a position upon the issue of Ukraine? Because, you know, that's an issue where the peace movement has been really divided. Most groups, you know, condemn the invasion of Ukraine, but they also recognize that, you know, the United States and NATO were provoking Russia, and they also sort of split over whether the United States should be sending any type of military aid to prolong the war. Has Veterans for Peace taken any position formally on this? Or do you have a position?
Yes, they have. And if anyone's interested in reading their actual position papers on it or anything else, they can go to veteransforpeace.org. Very easy to find on the internet, veteransforpeace.org. I can't recall right now specifically what some of it said. I don't know whether, and I can't talk to this too much except for my own personal view about NATO. I'm not sure Veterans for Peace is asking the U.S. to get out of NATO, though I wouldn't be surprised if they did. My personal opinion is that that is certainly something we should do. If you're seeking to end war, you should stop military alliances. And that's what NATO is, basically a military alliance. And, you know, they talk about being defensive, but there's different ways to defend yourself in the war. Veterans for Peace was opposed or is opposed to this $40 billion aid, military aid to the Ukraine, because it's kind of, you want to stop war, well, then don't be arming other people. And that's, and history has proven how wrong that position is, because it just keeps escalating and escalating. I mean, the logical next step for the United States would be give nuclear weapons to the Ukraine. Well, we're not going to do that, of course, but let's face it. This is, I'm sure some policymakers would try and make a case for it. So Veterans for Peace does take positions on these and is generally towards the aim of stopping all wars and ending particular conflicts, but abolishing war altogether.
So we've been talking with Dan Wilcox, local peace activist, Veterans for Peace, poet, about Memorial Day. Dan, if people want to check out your poetry, you got a website?
I do. I would actually encourage people to go to the Hudson Valley Writers Guild website, the recently revamped website, and there's a section on there where you can read works not only by me, but by lots of other local and regional poets. It's hvwg.org, or just Google Hudson Valley Writers Guild.
Thank you very much, Dan. This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Mech.
As I walk through this wicked world, searching for light in the darkness of insanity, I ask myself, is all hope lost? Is there only pain and hatred and misery? And each time I feel like this inside, there's one thing I wanna know. What's so fun about peace? So funny about peace, love, and understanding.
As I walked on through troubled time, my spirit gets so downhearted sometimes. So where are the strong? Who are the trusted? Where is the harmony?
Sweet harmony, 'cause each time I so fun about peace, love.